Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. This is The Sound of Photography, and I'm Frank Watson. As you know by now, this show deals with all things photographic. And my guest, my special guest this week, is James Hyman. And welcome to the show, James.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for inviting me.
James is an art historian, a curator, a gallerist, and collector. He is also a leading voice on British art and photography. In 1999, he opened the James Hyman Gallery, specialising in contemporary British art. Over the last 30 years, he with his wife Claire has built the Hyman Collection into one of the leading collections of British photography in the world. In 2020, he founded the Centre for British Photography, and we're going to talk a lot more about that centre as the show goes on. So there's a website if you want to look at about the centre. It's www.britishphotography.org. So that's fairly straightforward. James, we're going to start with you at the tender age of about 14, I think, because you won a prize.
Yes, my starting point, I guess, in terms of photography was my father, when he moved from one job to another, was given a camera as a present, as a leaving present.
Right.
I remember it was a Canon AE-1. And he wasn't really a photographer, and so I got to use the camera. What was exciting is I went out with a friend, Googe Street, Warren Street, Tottenham Court Road, round there, taking photographs. And this was my very first attempt to take photographs, black and white film. Anyway, I had a cousin who had a darkroom in his home. And so I took these photographs and went to my cousin's darkroom and developed the pictures and discovered, and I don't remember how, but discovered there was a competition each year that the Greater London Council had. The year I did it was called Metropolis, Portrait of a City. And so the very first roll of film I took, the very first pictures I ever developed, I submitted one of those to this competition, age 14, and actually won. And this was 1981, I think it was, £250 to spend on photographic equipment.
Wow.
So at that point, I thought, well, this is what I want to be. I want to be a photographer. I loved taking photographs, and seemed to be, I people thought I was good at it.
You had a talent.
So that was very, very exciting. And, you know, I was in various newspapers and Evening Standard and different places, and first time I ever talked to the press. And so, you know, it was an amazing start.
Yeah.
That's what set me off in terms of photography.
Must be very exciting.
It was. I mean, I remember the elation when they phoned me up and said you'd won, and this kind of surge of adrenaline. It was really an amazing moment.
So were you looking at other photographers' work, or were you completely innocent in terms of, you know, pioneering photographers?
I knew very, very little. So I didn't come from a background where photography was an interest, either in terms of taking it or really visiting exhibitions. We went to a lot of exhibitions, but they weren't photography. What I had seen, and I think somebody had given me, was the little paperback book. It was a reissue of André Curtez's On Reading, which I still think is a fantastic little publication. I think it first came out in the early 70s and then got reissued in the early 80s. So I had this little, I think, Penguin paperback of that.
And
so
that's a book of just people, I think mainly in Paris or certainly France.
And New York, people on balconies or park benches, and the theme of every picture is their reading.
Sort of absorbed in their own world of text and reading.
So there was that. And then in terms of exhibitions, I think the first photography show I saw was 1982 at the National Portrait Gallery. there was a show of Bill Brandt portraits. Mm-hmm. And then a little bit later, there was an amazing show at the Barbican, I think not long after it had opened, or certainly the first show I'd seen there, which was called American Images. And that was American photography from 1945 to 1980. And that made a really big impact.
It was a show that I also saw. I mean, it really was, it bowled you over with the range of work, and it showed you from the early work right the way up to sort of Cindy Sherman and people like that.
Yeah, I think I probably responded most at that point to the most European-like, because I think by then I knew about Curtis and Henri Cartier-Bresson. Mm. So I would have seen Frank or Winogrand or Friedlander in those terms, in terms of European street photography, I guess.
Sure. And so in a way, there was this sort of this shift in photography, wasn't there? I mean, but, you know, if you think about people like Ansel Adams and Edward Weston, I mean, that was an eye-opener at that show for me, but also that sort of street-style photography. So you, when you got your prize, were you aware of street photography as a sort of discipline?
I think street photography and portraiture I got. Mm. I think it wasn't until later that I would really have got Weston or Ansel Adams or, you know, that kind of landscape, American landscape, seemed more remote than pictures of people
almost on
the street.
Alien, I would say, especially in the case of Ansel Adams.
So I think less that. And I think I didn't know anything about printing or vintage prints or, you know, I was very ignorant about how a print might look. And I think since then I've been quite obsessed in a way with the object quality of photography, that when you put on an exhibition, is it vintage prints or is it later prints, what the size is, how the photographer originally wanted the work shown. Right. And I think this is one of the great challenges with photography within, you know, the different art media is, you know, we consume it on Google Images, we consume it on our phones and our computers, and yet the experience of it in a gallery is different. You've got the scale, you've got the way it's printed, you've got the presence, and you've got a different time factor of you sitting or standing in front of a work. Yeah. So, you know, we'll come on to talking about the centre, but part of what I wanted to do was to, you know, talk about photography as art objects, not just something to be consumed in the print medium, in the press.
Something that's tactile.
Yeah, and that has its own special presence in the world. It isn't just a digital file.
Also, you're looking at originals on a, you know, on a good exhibition. You know, you're looking at original prints, often printed by the photographers themselves. So it sort of adds to the sort of aura of the picture, perhaps.
I think that's right. And because I've always been interested in painting and drawing and not just photography, you know, I like it if there's a sign of the artist's hand.
Right.
You know, you get that in early prints, which early photographs, which I love from the 1840s, 1850s. You know, they're very intimate, they're handmade, the chemicals may have been splashed on, there are variations. And I think this is one of the things that does engage me in photography. You can have a medium that is very, very uniform, and every print in an edition can deliberately be perfect and the same. But it's also got this potential to be one-off.
Yeah.
Or experientially, size can make such a difference. The way something is installed can make such a difference. So I know a lot of photographers think about the book, the printed manifestation of what they're doing. I suppose I've always been particularly interested in the exhibition, about that physical encounter, not just the encounter quietly on your own, turning the page. I love the fact that you can stand in front of something and experience it. And also that might be a shared experience. There is something exciting about going to a gallery. Hopefully there's not so many people, you know, you can see the works properly. But there's something about that as a collective experience, which I think is special.
Talking about photographers that you've encountered, but previous to that you were dealing with painting.
Briefly, I wanted to be a photographer. And I think I felt at the time, this is when I was in my mid-teens and then thinking about university or thinking about what next after school, I thought, well, I'd like to go to art school. I'd like to do photography. And I think I felt that I was steered more towards university. that there was a kind of sense that get a real degree.
Mm.
You can always fall back on a real degree. And if you've still got this crazy idea of going to art school, you can do it later.
Was that your choice or was it a parental sort of influence going on there?
Well, my mother denies that this was a parental one, but it might have been a school one.
Right.
They might have understood better in those days.
Yeah.
You know, supposedly a bright child going to university than somebody going to... I think the view of art schools is this was the misfits.
Yeah, and perhaps seen in terms of mucking about and not taking life seriously enough.
So certainly I felt, wherever it came from, that, you know, do the university side.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I did history of art. I did the nearest thing I thought I could do to doing art. And so I ended up doing a master's. I ended up doing a doctorate. I was at the Courtauld in the end, I think 9 years, doing my master's, my doctorate, and then teaching there.
Mm-hmm.
And the subject that I studied for my doctorate was about art, particularly painting, after the Second World War, and the relationship between the way art was promoted and politics.
Mm.
So it was looking at art in the Cold War. And so I was always interested in thinking about an audience for art, thinking about the way John Berger was talking about communication.
Right, in ways of seeing, yeah.
Ways of seeing, but, you know, in his critical writing from the 40s and 50s, he's very much talking about the artist's responsibility to communicate in a direct, unelitist way, that everybody should be able to access what's being shown. And then you'd have, on the other side, somebody like David Sylvester, where it was more personal, more existential.
Yeah.
It would be a Francis Bacon or a Giacometti. And I was interested in these two sides. How can something be very personal, but also feel a responsibility to an audience?
Right.
So my background was painting. And then for various accidental reasons, I ended up being an art dealer.
Mm.
And it seemed to me logical that I would be dealing in the people that I had got to know.
And studied. Yeah.
And so a lot of what we did at the gallery was painting post-war.
Right. And these were people you got to know, for instance, Kossoff and Frank Auerbach, Bridget Riley. And I think you had sort of personal friendships with these people, is that right?
Yeah, I was very fortunate that I got to meet them in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
I was in my late teens. And they weren't, you know, the stars that they became.
Right.
And there was, you know, I remember Leon Kossoff the first time I went to see him, sort of saying, well, why are you interested? As though nobody would be interested.
Is that right?
And it felt like you were part of a very, very small community of fanatics.
So he must have felt really on the edge in terms of the world of painting.
Well, I think there would have been respect in certain circles, but there was certainly no expectation of commercial success.
Is that because of a rather conservative, traditional viewpoint of art or painting at that time, you know, that sort of modern painting was seen as a threat towards the more classical ideas of painting?
Well, you'd had in the late 60s, 70s conceptual art.
Mm.
So you'd had painting looking as though it was old-fashioned. But you'd also had within Britain, you know, there's a very strong landscape tradition. There's a strong St. Ives kind of abstraction.
Right.
And to have very kind of bloody, fleshy, emotional, urban realism, Bacon,
almost
Freud,
tactile, isn't it?
You movie. Know, it was sort of almost seen as un-English, that you're showing all your emotion.
Mm.
But it did feel as though, you know, you were part of a small kind of group that loved this work.
And the fact, and you were quite young when you sort of befriended them, that they trusted you, I suppose, because you had a training and you knew what you were talking about, you know, because of your PhD and your...
Well, I got to know them, Frank and Leon, I got to know when I was doing my BA, in fact. And I think I was quite direct. You know, if they asked me what I thought, I would say. And I kind of marvel at it in retrospect because, you know, Leon would say, he'd show me his new paintings and say, what do you think? And it was only later that I thought, well, actually, that may have got destroyed. You know, it did have consequences.
Off the back of your comment. Yeah.
You know, it did have consequences when somebody asked. Yeah. But I would always be very honest. I wasn't sycophantic. And I've always tried to be very sort of direct and honest when people have asked an opinion.
Yeah.
Because it's an exchange. They're exposing themselves, but I'm exposing myself. So it was they were very kind of raw encounters in a way.
Mm. Good training.
Yeah, I guess so. So, I mean, I learned a lot from them.
Yeah.
I learned a lot from Bridget Riley.
Who is still alive out of the three we've mentioned.
Who's still around.
Is she still painting?
She's still painting. She's just got a show that's just opened in Margate at the Turner. Yeah. So, you know, it was very, very exciting.
Okay, we're going to play a choice that you've made by David Bowie. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, I've tried to choose some pieces of music that remind me of particular moments in time or emotional or you know, just different moments. In terms of David Bowie, I would say I've probably listened to him every day of my life since 1979.
Really? God.
So this is, I had to have something by David Bowie, and I thought that, you know, how I got into David Bowie is my brother, Peter, at school won a competition and was given the new David Bowie album, which was the Gatefold of Lodger. And we listened to that, this, you know, the 12-inch vinyl, and just thought this is just great. You know, we just couldn't get into it at all. So I remember spending our time in my parents' living room using it as a frisbee. You know, this is what the 12-inch vinyl became, was a frisbee. But then I started listening to it, and I just thought this music was like nothing I'd ever heard. I thought it was extraordinary.
Right. So you were patient with it and gave it a...
So I was, and I still think Lodger is one of the most difficult albums he ever did.
Right.
But it very soon got me onto his earlier albums, and the one he'd done shortly before, one of them was Low.
Mm.
And the piece of music I would listen to again and again and again was Breaking Glass, just on repeat in my bedroom. So this is just summing up that period.
And the fact that it's only 2 minutes long is... Well, endless repeats.
Such a short piece of music. Again and again.
This is The Sound of Photography, and we're continuing to speak with James Hyman, and we're going to get on to you collecting photographs. So what was the first print you ever collected? When does a collection begin? I'm sure a collection never really ends, but...
I was trying to remember the first print, and I think what it was 1998.
Right.
Simon Norfolk did this incredible book called For Most of It, I Have No Words.
Right, I remember it,
And, you know, it includes some beautiful landscapes. You mentioned earlier Edward Weston, but, you know, there are one or two snow scenes in there that are almost Edward Weston-like. And yet each picture is then accompanied by a text that shows that they were sites of genocides and atrocities. And so it's a way that nature just continues. You know, there are these scenes where, you know, in history, events happened.
Right.
And nature just continues and takes over, and the seasons pass.
I'm trying to think of the country that he was doing.
All over.
Oh, was it? Yeah, I thought it was maybe just Iraq.
No, it's all over. It's in Europe. It's on the African continent. The pictures we got were small, square, very beautiful, but then had this very, very loaded backstory. And we got those from an art fair in early 90, or mid 98, I think it was. And I saw Simon not that long ago and mentioned this. And he said, well, I think you might have been the first people to buy the work.
Oh, right.
But for me, it was, you know, it was part of the story behind it was interesting, as well as the fact that they were beautiful pictures. Mm. And the ones we chose were probably easier ones to live with than some of the others that were really tough.
Right.
But I still think that's a great, great book.
Yeah.
You know. So that was the starting point. But there was nothing systematic or planned or whatever, you know. It was sort of...
So it was a parallel sort of interest while the painting, your interest in painting was going on in your conversations with painters. Or is there a sort of jump from one to the other?
I think what there was is that I was very fortunate that in the early 2000s, you know, there was a bit of an art market boom. And so the gallery business selling painting was doing well. And I'd always loved photography. And compared with the often mad prices for painting and particularly contemporary art, photography seemed just amazingly good value. And I still think it is. And so I was dealing in painting, but starting to collect a bit in photography.
Right. So, I mean, I remember actually a friend of mine buying a Muybridge for very little money. And thinking back now, you just think, gosh, I wish I didn't have a lot of money then. But, you know, ridiculous, really. When
Well, I mean, I think I've got a Martin Parr black and white photograph, and on the back of it, it's somebody's annotated in pencil, £10. And I think that was the price of Martin Parr's work in the 80s at the Photographer's Gallery.
Sure, sure.
You know, so it was a different world, but it's still, you know, I think underappreciated, whether you're talking critically or commercially, compared to most other art media.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So you started with Simon Norfolk and they're not, you got the bug a bit.
Well, I did, and I've got very good friends in the States who were collecting, and I started going visiting auctions, Sotheby's and Christie's in London, with them. Not to buy, but just it was a sort of pleasure to handle the works. And you could see work by Moholy Nagy or Edward Weston or whoever, Paul Strand. And so I started educating myself about what these prints could look like and what was on the market. But it took quite a long time after that before I bought anything, you know, sort of expensive. And it just really, really excited me that there were these opportunities. But nearly everything that we got at that point was from photography dealers in America, because it's a much more developed scene.
Yeah, they really appreciate their photography.
Yeah, in terms of publications, exhibitions, institutional support, but also commercial. So there are a lot of great galleries. You know, Stephen Data, who's got a gallery in Chicago, you know, we'd have late night phone calls and he would just talk and talk and talk and I would learn and learn and learn. And Hans Krauss in New York, you know, they were these great, great dealers who would share information. And so that side of it was very important.
Do you think
to me.
They were more benevolent because you were British and not American? And or did they think...
Well, they might have been more benevolent because I was buying things.
Oh, right. but maybe you were also extending the market to the UK. And that in a way, they saw you as a sort of bridge.
Well, I think what they saw is that this was another generation.
Right.
That actually, if you can get somebody younger interested in 19th century photographs or classic modern photographs, you know, you're developing a new collector.
Right.
Because so much of the attention even then was on contemporary.
Right.
And I love contemporary, but I'm also excited about the whole history of photography. And so they were educating me. Mm. So the collection we built up then, to be honest, was very, very American. Paul Strand, Edward Weston, Callahan, Siskin, Meatyard. It was all very American, very modernist. And as we started collecting in other areas, it just wasn't sustainable. So, in fact, we had a sale in 2007 at Christie's in New York, did a single owner sale of our collection one evening. And that was of the modern pictures, which was classic modernist works, because I was moving into other areas.
Right.
So that was a sort of...
So you'd shifted your sort of interest and your territory
to
focus more on contemporary, but also were financing it by selling the the modernist pictures.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. It was a way of... I mean, what we made from that sale went back into photographs. Mm. It's just I'd shifted the focus of what we were collecting. Yeah.
And you must have thought through that quite carefully, you know. Wouldn't be something you just do, you know, as a sort of chancing opportunity. Is that right?
The collection was very... I felt very emotionally invested in each piece.
So it's quite hard to sell.
So you're letting something go.
Yeah, that's tough, isn't it?
You know, and I've had this as a collector and as an art dealer. Mm. If, as I do, I love what I'm doing and I love the pieces that I get to handle or I get to collect, a lot of the excitement is discovering it, researching it. You know, I research before, I research after. I
before,
love all that
before
teaching.
You buy.
Yeah, but I love all the teaching myself to find out more. Mm. You know, getting books, talking to the artist maybe, or talking to experts. And I love all that research. So there's a lot of excitement at the beginning. But then I suppose I have over the years been able to part with things.
Yeah.
But it allows me to get something else.
Yeah.
Something else that I can then research and enjoy and live with and all the rest of it.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, it's certainly in this country, as we've already mentioned, this idea that, you know, there's, I don't know, not exactly a fear of photography, but certainly seeing it as a rather, well, as a, maybe, you know, rather snobbishly as a craft rather than art. I mean, I think it has been accused of that because it's mechanically reproducible. But certainly that, you know, if we looked at, well, I was looking at creative camera in the 70s and 80s, there was this huge sort of American presence, you know, as we've talked about, Robert Frank, Dan Arbus, Gary Winogrand, all those people were hugely influential on British photographers, weren't they? And it's taken a long time, I think, for photography in this country to find its own sort of niche. Would you say that was...
Yeah, I think it's a big topic, but you look at somebody like Tony Ray Jones, you know, he was spending time in America.
For a little while, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, in the mid-late 60s, he was there getting to know American photographers, trying to sell to American institutions. So he obviously learned a lot from that milieu,
right.
And that's somebody who you would think of as quintessentially English.
Yeah. And actually, there's a whole room of his work at Tate Britain at the moment, which I came across. So,
right.
And they still look fantastic.
They do. Know?
They're really...
They're magical pictures.
They really are, yeah.
So, you know, for me, it was very exciting to... when we started collecting contemporary photographs, I was very interested in what was going on the African continent. And we were amongst the first people, for example, to buy Zanelli Moholi's work. And we've got Atty Patruruga and Peter Hugo and David Goldblatt. And I remember talking to one of the British photographers who I'd got to know, and he said, but I don't understand why you're doing that. There's great photography in this country. Why aren't you supporting what's happening in this country?
Was that quite confrontatory?
Yeah. But, I mean, he was right.
Yeah.
Because...
But sometimes you need those moments just to sort of take stock.
Yeah. And I stand by what we'd got, but actually it somehow felt more... I can say useful, to contribute more, doing something in this country.
Sure.
And I learned more and more about what was going on here. And I just thought, this is amazing. It's underappreciated. Fantastic photographers who still remain underappreciated internationally.
Right.
So a lot of what we did after that, as collectors, but then with the charity, was to do what we could in our small way to support, you could say, the underdog. And, you know, if there's a connection, when I was initially interested in Leon Kossoff and Frank Auerbach, they felt like the underdog,
right?
You know,
okay.
And photography.
So it's a bit of deja vu going on.
Well, it's sort of you can look at where the trends are and follow the trends, or you can look at the bits that somehow have got neglected. Mm. And I'm more interested in the areas that
the gaps
need elevating. Mm. And you know, I'm not alone in this. You know, what Martin Parr is doing with the foundation is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a different vision of British photography, so I see us as complementary. You know, there are initiatives that are based on the idea that this is underappreciated and that people should know more about it.
Mm. And that's emphasised really by, you know, the major British institutions, you know, dare I say, Tate Modern, Tate Britain, and, you know, Royal Academy. You seem very reluctant to show photography on a regular basis, or they... You know, they do the occasional blockbuster in the case of Tate Modern, Tate Britain, but it's quite sporadic, isn't it?
Well, I think There's a slight contradiction, which is, I think, when there's a photography show that is staged, the audience figures are huge. People are kind of taken aback. They suddenly seem to be surprised that this is a huge audience.
As is the case with Lee Miller at the moment. Yeah. I mean, I've been twice and it's rammed.
Or you go to the 80s, you know, it may have got mixed reviews, but it was packed and they had fascinating things in it.
Yeah.
You know, we were one of the main lenders to that show. And every time I went, which was several times, it was packed.
Absolutely.
So there's the contradiction is there's this enormous audience for photography, but the institutions historically haven't collected it in the way that they might.
Is it changing?
I still think that the Tate should have a permanent full-time curator of British photography. That the Tate is so enormous, it's too much for one person to be doing everything. Right. So if you've got a photography curator at Tate Modern looking at the world, it would be good to have somebody at Tate Britain supporting British photography.
Okay. Well, maybe there's a job for someone there. Right, we're going to play a bit more music. This is Paul McCartney. Tell us.
Yeah, this is maybe I'm amazed, and my reason for choosing this, I think I've got a professional reason and a personal one. The professional one is that I think it was 2007, I curated with Paul McCartney an exhibition of Linda McCartney's photographs.
Okay.
And professionally, that's been one of my highlights. That was just an amazing experience. So it's a kind of nod to that. But the other one is just on the personal side that, you know, what I've done, you know, is very much a journey that I've taken with my wife, Claire. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the support that she's shown me, you know, we're very much in it together. It's a okay. love song.
Okay, here we go.
Amazing.
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM and on digital, and this is The Sound of Photography, and we're still talking with James Hyman, and we're going to talk about moving from collecting to the idea of an establishing a centre for photography. So what are the sort of origins of that idea?
So as collectors, we went from, you know, collecting in a very ad hoc way to increasingly focusing on British photography.
Right.
And the collection grew and grew. And particularly when I was in America, I would get American curators saying, you know, who should we know about? Which British photographer should we, you know, maybe we know about Bill Brandt, we know about Chris Killip, but who should we look at? And so we took the step of then setting up a website with the pictures that we had, which already by then were many thousands of works. And I did it in a very, very naive way because, you know, private collections don't tend to put their works online. And the naivety of it was that I didn't really think through what the consequences of that might be. And one of the consequences was that we got lots and lots of loan requests from institutions because we'd made it very, very easy. Here's what we've got. And very
had you advertised the idea that this work could be loaned out?
No, but people then saw that here it is.
Yeah, you know? It's sitting there waiting.
Yeah, and we wanted to share the work. You know, part of having the website was as an educational resource, so we wanted to share it that way. I just hadn't thought through that suddenly there'd be all these loans. And our loans were and have always been free of charge. We now, because there's a lot of loans and I'm trying to generate some money for our charity, the admin is now done through the charity, so there's an admin fee. But as collectors, we never wanted to charge.
Oh, really? That's quite...
So, you know, we want the work to be seen.
Yeah, yeah.
So we wanted to make it as easy as possible. You know, you just send round a van, there's one address. In most cases, the work is framed. So make it easy. Mm. And get the work out there. So we were lending more and more. And then we were thinking, well, how do we also support British photography? Okay, let's donate work. And where would it matter? And we thought it would be making a difference if it was somewhere that did a teaching, so you'd reach a new generation, and display. So Yale Centre for British Art was one place, and we donated 125 works to them. The Bodleian Libraries, you know, which under Richard Ovenden has done an amazing job starting to build up archives of British photography. And so we donated 100 works there. And I think what was important about both of those is that they were institutions that weren't associated with photography.
Yeah.
So the publicity that these donations made, like Will Boyd did a big piece in the Financial Times about the Bodleian gift, we're waving a flag for these institutions saying, look, we are interested in photography. And so I thought this could have a kind of, this could be a catalyst for maybe other people giving work. So
bringing people together and having conversations.
Yeah. So I think it was in its small way, a way of putting them on the map in terms of photography collecting in a way that meant that other people would then support those institutions. And so... Yeah, so the journey was the website and then the donations. And then in 2019, 2020, thinking about setting up a charity. And so we set up the charity in early 2020 with the aim of supporting British photography through grants. And the grants program is something that's very important to what we do. And... an exclusive for you is that we're relaunching in January with our next lot of grants, which will be in an expanded form.
Oh, okay.
So we're actually, it's been a great success and we want to build on that. So there will actually be an expanded grants program from January. But the next stage of that was that then I had some very, very good advisors and took soundings, you know, is it good to have a venue, bricks and mortar? Or is it better to be more grassroots? Should we be supporting, you know, festivals or local community projects?
Right.
Or is it good to have a flagship? And I think there was quite a strong view that having somewhere in London, the crucial thing wasn't about it being in Westminster or whatever. It was being on a tube line, being accessible by bus. But being in London where you could get an international audience as well. Because I think there are these fantastic museums across Britain.
Mm.
You think about Hepworth Wakefield, where we did a show of the collection.
Right.
Or you think about the museum in Bradford. But do people go and visit them?
No.
And you may get a local audience, you may get a national audience, you may not get an international
audience.
But that's
not sustainable in the end, is it?
So they may not be sustainable. No. You know, that depends on local authorities as well as Arts Council, etc.
Sure.
But I just thought, if we have a flagship in London, we are trying, like when we donated to the Yale Centre for British Art, to reach an international audience. And we have fantastic local initiatives across the country reaching local audiences.
Mm.
My ambition was to do something that would be national and international.
Right. So you find a building in Jermyn Street, is that how you call it?
Jermyn
Street, sorry, yeah. I mean, it was a beautiful building, and I remember it being if you were in the photography world, it was a very exciting time, because the gallery is on several floors, but there seemed to be like four or five shows going on at once, which, you know, I'm not comparing you with the photographer's gallery, but there seemed to be such a range of work going on that there was always something there to get really excited about. I mean, I was particularly taken with people like Mandy Barker and her work on plastics. It was lovely to see Daniel Meadows' work. And one of the great evenings I had was when you put together, I think it was Armet, Francis Vanley Burke and Charlie Phillips in a talk. These are the sort of the grandfathers of black photographers, you know, going all the way back. And they had a thoroughly good time talking to each other. And it was a real celebration of their work and their, you know, their time in photography.
And we had Grace Lau's portrait studio where you could book an appointment and be photographed. Yeah. That was fantastic. Yeah. Rosie Martin did phototherapy all-day sessions.
Mm.
It was incredibly dynamic and lively and vibrant.
It was, yeah.
And we had, I think, about five shows at one time.
Oh, I got that right.
Yeah. Free of charge, which was really, really important to us. And having worked in gallery spaces for a long time, I know how intimidating it can be for people to walk in the front door. And so part of what we tried to do was to personally welcome people coming in so that people felt it was for them.
Okay.
And in the first 3 months, I think we had something like 110 pre-booked groups.
Wow.
And I would speak to as many of them as I could personally.
Yeah.
Or otherwise people from my team would. And I had a very good gallery manager, Becky Martin, very good registrar, Sarai Garcia Alvarez. And we had a fantastic team.
Mm.
And it was really trying to say to people, this is for you. Whether it was, you know, kids from local schools, people from communities that might not have come otherwise, like Charlie Phillips, we did a show of his. We were trying to reach people. That maybe would have otherwise felt intimidated going to the gallery. Mm. So no barrier with an admission fee, and hopefully not feeling too intimidated there in Jermyn Street.
Yeah.
And what we did is the idea was always that this would be a proof of concept, that we'd have a lease which we signed for 2 years, and we would use that to demonstrate, you know, the vitality of British photography, but also the buy-in from the photography community, the support of our audience, the enthusiasm of the press, and that would be the platform, whether it was the Arts Council, foundations, individuals. And that is the great challenge in this political and economic environment, that people loved it. And it was dynamic.
Yeah.
It was vibrant. It was
really
exciting. But to get the support we need to go from it being a 2-year lease to something permanent is obviously a whole other order.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my team worked very hard. I was working 7 days a week. You know, I was putting everything into this, but also having to put a lot of money into it, you know, and it's not sustainable without support.
And you knew that from the beginning, or did it become clearer?
No, I thought it was self-evident that because we're supporting photography in Britain, this would be supported by the Arts Council.
Yeah.
So, you know, Arts Council, very problematic because successive governments have starved its funding. There ought to be a much more aggressive campaign to get it funded properly. There ought to be a much more aggressive campaign about the value of the arts in this country, not just photography.
Yeah, true.
You know, and that this shouldn't just be appealing to the Treasury, look how big this is as an economic sector. Mm. This should be a moral thing. This should be a quality of life argument. that the arts are actually what empower people, fulfill people, enliven, excite, you know, that there should be actually a mission statement. Institutions should be getting together and saying this is scandalous not to fund the Arts Council properly.
Yeah.
And great, argue that it should be devolved. It shouldn't all be centralised in London.
Absolutely.
But don't do it at the expense of London. Fund London as well. So it can only happen if you increase the pot of money.
Yeah.
So I thought it would be a no-brainer for the Arts Council to support us. I couldn't assume it. You can't assume anything.
No.
And I was realistic about the economic situation we were in, you know, and the fact that the government's changed and that's not increased the funding for the Arts Council shows there's a sort of consensus that it's acceptable to underfund the arts.
Mm.
But what that means in reality is if the pot doesn't change, we're all scrabbling after the same money.
Yeah.
And it becomes
more competitive than ever.
It does, and it's an appalling thing if something like the centre can only be funded by taking it away from somewhere else.
Yeah.
I don't want that to happen.
No.
I just want it to be funded properly.
Yeah.
And so I think what I found with the centre is it cost more to run than I'd expected. And I have to say, we were incredibly, I negotiated a zero rent lease. You know, I haven't said that publicly, but that is the reality. It was zero rent. And it was still enormously expensive because it cost so much to put on exhibitions. You know, so I was responsible about that. But it's just, even, you know, we can't just have pop-ups for 2 years or 1 year or whatever it is. We can't keep doing pop-ups. I want a permanent space. So my vision is that what we wanted to do is excite people about the potential and use that as a tangible platform.
It wasn't just a dream.
Look what we can deliver. But we need people to get on board. So what we do have is some money now from the Broccoli Foundation. That's the Cubby Broccoli. And that is helping, for example, with our grants program. And that should be foundational for a centre, for a permanent space. But we need other people to get on board as well.
Sure.
So that we use this as a platform. So, you know, my preoccupation is still how do we, in this economic and political climate, fundraise? And it's not easy.
Right. Okay, we're sort of moving along rather too quickly, you know, with the time we've got left. We're going to play a piece by Rihanna called Love on the Brain. Do you want to quickly say why this choice?
Just briefly. You know, for me, the most exciting thing I've done career-wise was opening the centre.
Absolutely, I'm sure.
But, you know, I didn't know how I would be with that because I'd had this period before that where I had two lots of spine surgery. I'd been on my back a long time. Anyway, the Rihanna piece reminds me of that period because my daughters, when they saw me in hospital, brought me these playlists. And one of the tracks on the playlist was Rihanna.
Right.
So as I was recovering, I would listen again and again to this Rihanna piece.
Right.
And so that reminds me of the moment before the centre took off.
Musical therapy.
Well, there we go.
Just to get close to you, we burn something today. And I'll run for miles just to get a taste. Must be love on the brain. That's got me feeling this way. It beats me black and blue, but it fucks me so good, and I can't get enough.
is The Sound of Photography. We're continuing to speak with James Hyman. We're talking about really the gallery as a sort of physical space coming to an end. But we could sort of also talk about this idea of your sense of working with other photographic communities in a way, sort of embracing other sort of institutions where quite often I think they're seen as in competition with one another. I mean, people like Autograph, University of Westminster, Four Corners, Bodleian Library, Birkbeck, you know, they were all being embraced by you in the centre. And that seems really refreshing because, you know, it's so easy to think everyone's scrapping for the, you know, the same sort of space in many ways.
Yeah, I think there are two parts to that. The first is obviously when you're in the midst of stuff and you're working flat out, you're by nature inward looking. But what we did when we set up and when we did the website for the Centre for British Photography is a whole section of the website. I think this is unheard of, but there's a whole section listing maybe 60 institutions or bodies that are supporting in various ways British photography. And you could say, you know, answering your question, you could say, well, look, this is all our competitors. Why are you advertising all our competitors? But the point was that this is a community and, you know, we want to be part of that. We might be a London hub for regional galleries. One of our ideas was that this would be a space that regional shows could come to London, because there's often this kind of idea that London puts on the show.
Starts and it's with London and then
benevolently bestowed on the regions. But we wanted to be somewhere that could take these great shows in London. Mandy Barker is actually an example of that, which you mentioned before, on marine plastics. That was a show that had been done by the National Trust, and we brought it to London.
Wow, I didn't
know
that.
So, you know, we were very, very keen on publicising what other people were doing, because, you know, we might have been a hub, we might have been a centre, whatever that means, and it's a loaded term, but we wanted to be part of things. We wanted to work with others, and, you know, you may say it's to do with rivalries and territory.
Traditionally, yeah.
But, you know, idealistically, I thought, you know, we're an important part of the mix. There isn't an institution with a collection like ours, for a start, so we can lend. But, you know, let's do something that enhances photography, which is what our all of our mission is. Right. So let's work together on that. But it's not always easy. As I say, people are busy, you know, I understand it.
Yeah, with their own little pool of interest. Yeah,
yeah. But that's the aim, and that's why there is this section on the website.
Mm. So in terms of the future for the centre, where do you see it going?
Well, the bits that are very active at the moment publicly are we're lending a lot of works. We have a touring exhibition programme. We did a couple of shows not long ago that were with Belfast Exposed, for example, Arpita Shah's work and Joe Spence. So we did two shows with them. We were a big lender to the Tate Show on the 80s. So the work is getting out there. We're also expanding our grants program. So that's been very successful. I think last year we got 574 applicants. So, you know, there's quite a lot we're doing without having a physical space.
Right.
But yes, my time, what I'm trying to do, is still realise that space. Rightly or wrongly, I still remain committed to the idea that it's London. Just because I think there's such a big audience that we have potential to reach.
Right. Realistically, can you see a sort of physical centre coming about in the next 5 years?
Well, what we need is multiple sources of funding.
Yeah.
So that is my ambition. I'd like to, you know, I'd like to be in there tomorrow. It depends on others. You know, if tomorrow a government funded the Arts Council properly, that would be revolutionary. You know, that would be transformative in this
country.
But
isn't it more realistic to think of, you know, the Elton Johns of this world who have been very, you know, interested in photography. And, you know, there's a lot of people in this country with a lot of money and probably a lot of them don't know what to do with it. And you wonder,
I think one of the things we've found
so private funding would seem to be a more feasible sort of position.
Yeah, I hope that having demonstrated what we could achieve, that it becomes more easy, because otherwise somebody might decide, well, look, the Victoria and Albert Museum have been there for a century and a half. This is solid. who are these upstarts?
Right.
So I need somebody who's excited by the fact that we're new and dynamic and energetic.
Yeah. Right.
But it may be a different donor.
Right. Okay. Well, I think we're coming to the end of the show. We've covered a lot, and, you know, let's really hope. And if anyone out there has money to spend, well, you know where to come, you know, come to the Centre for British Photography. So it's been great to talk to you, James. Thank you for doing it. Thank you, Peter, for producing the show. And we're going to play out with a bit of the specials, if I can line this up. And it's Enjoy Yourself. Why have you chosen this?
Yeah, two things, again, professional as well as personal, I suppose. But personal, let's say. Derek Greaves, the painter, one of the great British painters of the last half century, was a great friend of mine. Yeah. And I gave the eulogy at his funeral. And at the end of his funeral, I played some pieces of music that he had loved. So the funeral was very much a celebration of his life. Mm. So at the end of it, there was this joyful piece of music.
And this is the perfect.
But also, you know, I think that I have worked absolutely flat out trying to get the centre to work. And, of course, there are downs as well as ups. Mm. But it's been an absolutely amazing experience. Mm. And it's something I really believe in. So it's really about living in the present, enjoying the moment, absolutely, appreciating what you've got. And yes, there are hurdles, but enjoy yourself.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go.
Myself first. It's good.